Hello, hello, hello. It seems that this is one of those Thursdays. While we wait for Gareth to come on, I'm going to introduce our guest, Mr. Alec Hogg. Some of you may have seen him on his own platform called BizNews, biznews.com. And also, he does that very famous platform with all the politicians, everybody on stage, out in the Bundu somewhere. Mr. Alec Hogg, welcome.
Hi, Pumi. Not in the Bundus anymore. Used to be in the Bundus. We now have it in the metropolis of Hermanus. So they're all
In
happier, yeah, to come down to the seaside.
bustling metropolis of Hermanus. Thank you for
Well,
coming on. I think today is definitely one of those Thursdays because I had a tough time getting up and getting here this morning. And when I got here, Jack was complaining about his own insomnia, and now Gareth is still struggling to come on. But there's so many things happening, as is every single damn week in this country, it seems now. Every single week, it's the news cycle has gone apeshit. And you're here to help us unravel some of this. And also, as a seasoned journalist, as a seasoned newsman yourself, I think you can help me, definitely who is not, also understand a little bit behind the scenes, some of this unraveling and what isn't happening that should be happening. Welcome, Gareth.
yes, good morning. Hi, Alec. Nice to see you.
Gareth, good to see you too, man.
Yeah, hello, Pooms.
Hello, Bebe.
I liked your little introduction, and I couldn't have said it better myself. We need someone with wisdom and the ability to give us context, and that's why we've got Alec this morning.
Listen, today, as we wait for, so what are we? About 4 hours away from an historic moment with the first one that we've actually had, because we haven't had this yet, an MK party press conference
Right.
this afternoon at 12. What are
Well,
you saying?
there was one. There was that a very abortive one straight after the elections, where, they had a bunch of people who, including the former president Jacob Zuma, who rattled on for hours until I think everybody in the country gave up. But there was that one.
Okay. I'm going to ask Jack to come and help me. I don't know what's happening, but the lights seem to be flickering here. It's not quite load shedding, but maybe it's just not. I don't know what's happening. But what are you expecting? What do you think is going to be on the agenda for Mr. Zuma and friends? Thank
Me or
you.
Alec?
Anyone, both of you.
Alec, what do you think? Because MK, I mean, really, it's just like such a home for all the state capture, disgruntled losers. It's like, and now, having attracted Floyd Shivambu to their ranks too, I mean, they're probably feeling quite powerful. But I think to some South Africans, this is a very, very worrying thing that all of these guys are over there.
I think to many South Africans, we had a wonderful interview with Jabulani Khumalo that Chris Steyn did over the weekend. He's the guy who started MK and then went along to Jacob Zuma because he thought it would give MK the momentum that it needed as a new political party. And he then alleges, and I don't know why he would allege this if it wasn't true, that Dudizili and her daughter went into the back end of Cipro, removed him as a director, put themselves as directors, and then did all kinds of things that they weren't supposed to be doing. And I asked R.W. Johnson, who is was an Oxford University don, as they call them, these professors in political science for 26 years. I said to him, "This is crazy stuff. What do you think?" He said, "Well, it's not unexpected because that's the way that Zuma has operated forever. The family operates like that, so don't start thinking that this is something new. What will be new, though, is for how they address, because that interview went viral. I think last I looked, it was over 400,000 people had watched it. And
Wow.
the what will be interesting is how MK squares off against that of what Jabulani Khumalo had to say. He does look like a bit naive, an honorable person who just fell in amongst a bunch of thieves or hyenas. And if you go through the list of who's in MK, it's like a who's who of the Zondo Commission. So, or who should be joined by the Zondo Commission. So I'm with you on that one.
And of course, we read this, all of Jabulani Khumalo's allegations in his affidavit. Another thing that is not new to Mr. Zuma, because now there is a second case in the Western Cape High Court of those MPs that have been summarily dismissed from their parliamentary duties in the MK.
It's all extraordinary. And I guess we as South Africans, the big thing we've got to do is to treat it seriously, because it is serious, a serious threat to democracy. I remember my colleague, Dirk Hartford, who's been around the block many, many times. He comes from a struggle background. And he wrote in the very beginning of MK, said, watch out, these are the anti-constitutionists who are going to try and kill our democracy. And my goodness, they have certainly gone along that road over the past few months. So, yeah, we mustn't be like the people. I don't want to make crazy parallels here, but when Hitler came into power in Germany, most Germans of any intellect thought it was, oh, who's this buffoon? Who's this fool? He's never going to get anywhere. We've got to take these things seriously, because without democracy, what do we have?
Well, yeah, I get a little bit nervous when people saying defend democracy, because unfortunately the Democrats in America have been rolling this old line out so often now that anytime anyone who they don't like wins anything, they say, oh, we've got to defend democracy. You know, so it's become unfortunately perverted and corroded by politicians who very clearly don't understand the concept themselves. And now anyone who the Democrats in America doesn't like is suddenly a threat to democracy. And primarily it's all bound up in the fact that, and we just had the DNC this week, but it's all bound up in the fact that they actually are just an anti-Trump party at this point. It's the only thing that puts them together. Now, the thing about the MK people, and I do think that you're right to say that we should watch it carefully and we shouldn't completely write it off as being a stupid collection of, you know, disgruntled people who, as you rightly say, are more mentions of them in the Zondo Commission than in the books of history ever. But there is something that's happened here that I think is quite valid and important that we've got to take note of, is what Jacob Zuma has done is bring in a whole lot of people who we may not like, but we may very well know. Like, these are well-known names. Brian Molefe, now Floyd Shivambu. Tom Moyane, we've got Judge Tlope. What he's done is he's made it more than a one-man party, which was my big criticism leading up to the election and just after, is, okay, this is MK, it's a real thing. They've done better than any other first-time party in South Africa's history in this election, and we've got to take that seriously too. And I said at the time, oh, well, it's just a retirement plan for Jacob Zuma. That's what it was. But now, with all of these other characters involved, this could also be his succession plan. So there's a lot of, that wily old fox is also not someone you must underestimate. And I think maybe what he's done is he's brought in a bunch of people, and whether or not we like or dislike their ethical or moral take on things, he has got more than just him in the fold now.
Yeah.
You go first, Alec.
Yeah, it is true. But if you have a look at what binds them, it seems to be a collective ambition to stay on the rail. Because however you want to unpack this, and I think as South Africa starts growing up, as our democracy starts growing up, and please God, I'm on the same page as you are about the Dems in the United States. But as our democracy here starts growing up, we've got to start addressing these difficult issues. And I'm hearing more and more of that and seeing more of that from people who in the past kind of turned a blind eye towards it. It was always, well, you know, these guys came from the struggle, so actually they deserve to be looked after in some way. 30 years on, that argument doesn't hold water. And I'm saying that because I see that in the business community. It's almost like it has been in the business community a feeling that, well, as long as the guys don't steal too much, then we can carry on and go forward. And it's like the thief taking 10 Rand. Next time it'll be 100, then it'll be 1,000, then who knows where it ends. And I think that sobriety is now coming into the discourse and into the boardrooms, where there's no longer this, well, okay, as long as they let us carry on with our business, to one where, oh shit, if we allow a little bit of corruption, we just don't know where it's going to end. So I'm very hopeful about our country. I think, well, for the first time since 1994, in fact, for the first time ever, I guess, I'm starting to feel that we're becoming a little bit more grown up. And as a consequence, we will start doing the things that will unlock the potential in this incredible organization or a nation that we're in. I mean, we succeed so often elsewhere. But man, Bobby Godsell told me once in an interview, he said, we are blessed by our people, but cursed by our governors. And he reckons South Africa had been like that for 100 years. And I can't argue with him.
Yeah, well, built off the back of struggling gold and diamonds. You say what binds them together, these politicians that have now gathered around Jacob Zuma and this MK party. What do you think is the attraction for Floyd Shibambo? Because really, quite honestly, up until last week, there had been lots of talk about discontents, and it makes sense, right? The EFF is an 11-year-old party. They fared quite poorly in the last election. So there is bound to be fissures and ructions within that party. But I don't think anybody could have guessed Floyd Shibambo being the first person to jump ship. So what do you think the attraction is for him at the MK? And why leave EFF, which he co-founded now?
For me, I love going back when I'm a bit confused into the history of things. And the history here is exactly what happened with VBS. And if you read Advocate Terry Murtaugh's investigation, it was really, really interesting because it started off with everybody denying. It was flat out denied. Every single person he said that he interviewed denied. And then they explained to the people that they were interviewing that we are now applying an American law where if you fess up, you won't be, there'll be no criminal charge on that subject for you. And suddenly, he said, everyone turned 180 degrees. So it's been very, very smart the way that the investigators into VBS have managed all of this. And I think that it's about as close to an open and shut case as you can get. And then we get the former chairman coming out and spilling the beans on top of all of that. So I guess Floyd Shivambu and his brother, who are very, very clearly implicated in this. I'm not so sure that Julius might be able, I don't know the
it's
details.
It's a bridge too far. I think Julius is a bit of a bridge because there's nothing direct.
Yeah.
Other than the restaurant, maybe, other than the him being the head of the EFF, and now, judging from this week's utterances, now that we absolutely understand that this EFF is his own thing and nobody else. Other than that, I think that the connection to VBS for Julius is very tenuous.
So he might get away with it. Floyd ain't gonna. And if Floyd is now in that position, he's saying, yeah, but Zuma's done lots of crazy things and corrupt things, and he's not in jail. So maybe I'll go and side with him, and perhaps he's got something where he says to the judiciary, if you threaten me, I'm going to have another July 2021 revolution. So who knows what goes on in the minds of, in the criminal mind, but it could be something.
I think it's that, but I also think that's very linear. And the thing about a lot of these politicians is that they aren't always logical and sensible. I think a lot of it also has to do with, in his mind, he's taking a 9% party and trading a position for a position in a 14% party. So that's also logical. But the illogical part is that this gives him more cred for being a fighter, a black nationalist, a man who sides with, you know, the feel rather than the think. This is a guy who you can trust because he has given up all of the hard work that he's put into the EFF. in order to join something new because he believes in that cause. You know, there's a lot of ideology under all of this stuff that we mustn't underestimate. And for Floyd, it's like, look at me, I'm still a fighter. I haven't given up. I'm not on the losing end of this. You know, I think there's a part of that too, but I don't think Alec is wrong to say that it's also about personal survival.
And I suppose if we take a bit of a pivot and look into the EFF then, and what's transpired in the EFF in the week of Floyd's leaving, his resignation letter, which I'm sure you've seen because it's been doing the rounds, and how Julius responded 2 days ago, was it Tuesday, that he had his ground forces converging on Orlando Hall. And what do you make of that? What does this mean for the EFF and for Julius? They're going into an electoral conference this December.
Well, from now Mbuyi sending Ndlozi, right?
Well, you know, yesterday, obviously, there was a lot of, because of the outrageous things that Julius said on Tuesday. And for those of you who are listening who haven't seen, Julius absolutely kicked Mbuyiseni. If there was a dog to kick, it was Mbuyiseni on Tuesday, because he was very scathing about Mbuyiseni's silence. He was incredibly misogynistic about Mbuyiseni being unable to keep his wife in order, from getting her to not like Floyd Chibambu's Twitter posts, and absolutely unhinged, I think, Julius Malema coming out there and taking an aim. And quite clearly, now that Floyd is not there, it seems that Mbuyiseni is the next person that he's going to be abusing, because we've watched him abuse Floyd over the years, right? So yesterday, lots of speculation about Mbuyiseni's resignation, and also blatant lies, you know, so a fabricated resignation letter was doing the rounds on social media. But we also saw images of all of them looking very cozy and buddy-buddy at Lebogang Maile's home as they went to pay condolences for Lebogang, whose son passed away over the weekend. So I don't know about Mbuyiseni leaving, but still, what do you make of what's happening there in that 11-year-old party?
There's a lot going on in the background, and I became aware of this in the past 18 months or so, where certain people within the party were approaching certain people in the business community asking for support to challenge Julius. And so I looked at that and I thought, certainly when the people involved approached me and spoke to me about it, I said, whoa, I'd be very, very cautious. Maybe it's a trap. Maybe you're going to give some money and then the whole thing's going to blow up in your face. So I would strongly recommend that you stay away from this kind of internal political wrangling. But maybe maybe it wasn't a trap. Maybe it was true. Interesting. Now that, and we often see that, it's only often with the benefit of hindsight that you can understand what happened at the time. And that, if that were a genuine approach, then you can understand why Julius was unhinged, because perhaps he's coming from a different place, a place of knowledge that hasn't been in the public domain.
That's a very good point.
I saw somebody tweeting maybe a year and a half ago and calling Julius Malema Kidi Amin, which is my favorite. It's my favorite description of him, because he is a little bit like Idi Amin, right? And watching him on Tuesday, I realized after watching the Floyd Chibambu press conference, which was carried live on a lot of platforms, that I have never watched a Julius Malema EFF press conference from start to finish. I only just watch whatever outtakes are out there, and kind of, I'd rather read the speech. I'd rather read it than watch it. But I also wish we could have a conversation of just watching him on Thursday, sitting next to Floyd, and watching his body language and watching his face. And as he came up to say, look, he the three things that stood out to me was how sad he said he feels, because he said he likened it to getting the news of his mother's passing. He spoke about the doors open for Floyd to come back. They don't allow people to come back into the party when they leave, but the doors open for Floyd. And the third thing he spoke about was his grandmother, whom we've all heard Julia speak about his grandmother and his fondness for her, but his grandmother telling him he can't leave the party. And then we spent the whole day on Friday and Saturday and Sunday speculating about, is this a play by Julius Malema to send Floyd out into the MK, and maybe the progressive caucus, as they're calling themselves, will come together for the next election, wara, 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 wara. And then Tuesday happens.
Well, I'm amazed, because this is not something that we could have predicted. I mean, this is the decline and fall of the EFF, and it'll all be wrapped up long before the next election. I don't think that there's any way any of us could have foreseen this. Many people would have said the MK party will fall apart as soon as Jacob Zuma is too old or he dies or whatever else. But it's the EFF that'll die first. And I couldn't have guessed that. I don't know if anybody could have. Circumstances and a really poor election and a whole lot of things have contributed to that. But I'm kind of interested, because we've got Alec Hogg here, who really has spoken to the high and mighty, the powerful, the decision makers, the people in business who we rely on as like a, you know, we've got the politicians who are ostensibly our leaders. We've got the media who are ostensibly taking the role of the fourth estate and guarding the institutions and making sure that politicians are held accountable and all of that stuff. And I think some of the media have done a terrific job and some are a disgrace. And, you know, we really, as we discussed the other day, Pums, with Mandy Wiener, we can disregard and write off quite a large proportion of the media. And I think maybe business has been looked upon by most South Africans as a sensible kind of, these are the guys who will make sure that the economy still works. And the reason I say that is because when they appointed Nene, when Jacob Zuma appointed, when he appointed Des van Rooyen, all those years ago, and the business community said, whoa, 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 hold on. And this coterie of people went to see him at the union buildings and got him to reverse his decision. I think it was absolutely clear to all South Africans that there are levers that the business community can pull. There are leaders inside of the business community who can be the ones who could stand as a bulwark to complete stupidity. Alec said something just now that I want to probe a little more. He was, Alec, don't let me put words in your mouth, but you said the business community have been largely craven over the last 30 years of democracy. They've kind of, they didn't want to be too critical of the ANC, because the ANC is the biggest player, the government rather, is the biggest player in our economy.
And they make money, lots of it.
Absolutely. You cut off your nose to spite your face if you fight with government for no reason. And we've got that one occasion where people in banks and important institutions got together and said, no, 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 you can't do this. But other than that, we've seen them kowtowing left, right, and center. Whose fault is that? Are we putting too much faith in the business community, if there even is such a thing? And what can they actually do, in your opinion?
I think you've got to start from the basis of the two streams, Gareth. The one stream is the manager, the professional manager, and the other stream is the entrepreneur who's built a business. Now, the entrepreneurs who built a business, you would take the old guys at Investec, Stephen Kosoff, who was very involved in Nenegate or getting it reversed, von Rooyen's appointment reversed, Bernard Cantor, Adrian Gore, and Barry Swartzberg at Discovery. The old timers like the late Donald Gordon, people who've built up a business, Brian Joffe, from scratch, They've got FU money. And essentially what that means is that if somebody tells them to do something, they can say FU, because they don't need to be reliant on anybody. And they're the ones who really do play a critically important role in our economy, by having that FU money. And then you've got the professional managers who are appeasers. Because let's not forget, in a big corporate, to become the CEO of a big organization, you have to play internal politics. Generally, somebody who gets to those heights is not always the best person. Often the best people get frustrated and leave and start their own businesses or go somewhere. I mean, we know, Gareth, you and I from media, come on, we know the story. We know where we could have been and how different our lives could have been if we hadn't started on our own. And there's that kind of a situation that you have in big business. So start from that premise. And when you begin there, you will see that some have got balls and some have none. Or some have guns the size of rugby balls and some have testicles the size of peanuts. And that is where the beginning of that debate should come. Those who are professional managers are literally looking for the next cashing out of their share options, and most of their money is offshore anyway.
Yeah,
those who are here for
their money.
Yeah. So it's very, very important. Then you have a look at what at the history. So you get some of the entrepreneurs like the guys at First Rand, Paul Harris, Larry Dipinard, GT Ferreira. And First Rand remains very entrepreneurial and it thinks in the same way as the founders think. Johan Rupert, remember that chaotic Power FM engagement? Because Johan Rupert's got FU money. He doesn't need these guys, but of course it doesn't go down well when you've got politics that comes into it. He doesn't play politics well because he hasn't never had to, and he never probably will. But you recall when Paul Harris some years ago brought out, it was a small thing at First Rand, but they were critical of the ANC. They got slammed from on high. And the result of that was that they shut up, but so did everybody else. And so you've got this business, even if the guys with guns the size of rugby balls are made to shut up, then you can be sure that those with peanuts down there are going to very quickly appease and work in that way. So I would say a guy like, I know Adrian Gore is not everybody's favorite because of what happened on COVID, but I can tell you that he is a chap who's built a massive international business. He doesn't need to be here. I think the vitality now in the UK is bigger than Discovery in South Africa. It's a huge operation. They've got operations in China, in the US and everywhere else. But boy, is he committed to our country. And those kind of people, you've spoken with Rob Herself often. And Rob doesn't need to put his head above the parapet, but he did at a critical, critical time. And I think he made a change in the way that many people look up to these professional managers to give them leadership, and they never will.
But Alec, that is a double-edged sword in a way, right? So on the one hand, you have the FNBs and Standard Banks, the Paul Harrises and the Adrian Gores and all of those people who the bulk of their money was made through the chaos that we're in. If you're sitting in a bank and we have the kind of inflation that we have, before you wake up, just the interest rates have made such a bunch of tom for you that this chaos works for them, right? And then on the other side, the entrepreneurs that you speak of, the Joffies and the Kosevs and the Ackermans, all those guys are old and most of them have taken their money out of the country. So they're sitting pretty, right? And when you talk, and the other side of it is when you talk about market forces being the driver of some of these changes, then people are asking themselves, why the hell am I voting? If when we vote and we say the ANC needs to be a 40% party, and then the market forces say, actually, we need the kind of stability that puts Cyril Ramaphosa back into power as the head of the GNU. People are kind of going, what is this shit show that we're in? Why are we even voting? Why don't we just let the market forces decide everything on our behalf?
Yeah, there's so much that you've put there that we could spend the next hour. But let's start off. Entrepreneurship is about building something and providing a service. Entrepreneurship is not about profiteering and making money. That is trading. That is profiteering. That is tenderpreneurship. That's not entrepreneurship. Entrepreneurship is somebody who can see a way of providing a better service, and in that way, everybody benefits. So that's the starting point. The other point that I think is really, really important in all of this is that to build a country, you have got to be in a place where everyone has an opportunity to develop their own skills. Or if you're prepared to work hard and to sacrifice, you should get the benefit from it. Many, of course, society is uneven, unequal. That's where we've come from. But if you've got a government that says, well, I know better, and I'll actually decide who is going to win and who's going to lose, you're on your path to the Soviet Union disaster. And even in China, where the Communist Party still rules, they turned it around when Deng Xiaoping said that, I don't care what color the cat is, maybe he's black or white or green, but as long as he catches mice. And what he was saying there was, let's open up, let's unleash human potential. And that's the frustration I have when I look at the human potential in South Africa, where it is unleashed. Look at heavens above. Elon Musk is the richest guy in the world. Why isn't he at home? Why did he leave here at 17? Why didn't he not? And he's not alone. There are many Elon Musks, I believe, from all kinds of parts of our society, who are, if you give them the opportunity, if you just open up the playing field, let people participate, give me the chance to go and make a sacrifice. And if I make the sacrifice, let me be rewarded accordingly. It's not a case of, well, if I profiteer, then I'll be, you know, I'm cool and I've got all my money in the bank. These guys, that's not the way they think. I've spoken to enough of the billionaires and gotten to know them in enough of calm, private conversations to know that once you get past a certain level of wealth, then you think of different contributions. You make different contributions. You're not sitting like the rest of us saying, geez, how am I going to pay the bond this month? You're sitting in a place where you're saying, how can I make a contribution? It becomes about legacy. It becomes about my grandkids. I want them to have a better future. You know, that beautiful saying about a country's in the right direction when old people plant trees that they'll never sit under, because they have that faith in where we're going to. And I do believe that there's a process that we're going through where we will get to that point, that everybody looks around and starts realizing that actually there's a massive difference between entrepreneurship and tenderpreneurship. There's a big difference between making a contribution and being properly rewarded from it, or these blooming criminals who somehow subvert the laws of our society and become role models for young people to think, well, that's the way it actually works. That's the way you get wealthy, rather than the great generations of the world that have built great countries, where it's about character, not about personality.
Well, which is, I think, a wonderful segue to my favorite topic, which is the biggest dud we've been sold in this country. That is precisely the kind of thinking that everybody was trying to sell us with Cyril Ramaphosa. Oh, the man has made his money. He's rich and he's a businessman, and he will be able to turn this ship around. He is the good ANC inside a bad ANC. And yet here we sit. I mean, yesterday, and again, you know, to the issue of the media, he has been handled with such kid gloves in the media in South Africa. Yesterday, you know, the numbers comes out. Ooh, everybody's so excited that, you know, the inflation is at a 3-year low. Yeah, but it's still higher than it was when he arrived. But we're all supposed to be so happy that Cyril Ramaphosa and inflation is looking, and the GNU is winning. What do you think about the GNU and where we sit now with this particular president and what the forecast looks like? I mean, some of the news are also talking about next month, maybe looking at some interest rate cuts, which would be nice.
Yeah, well, let's start with Cyril. Cyril did not make his money as an entrepreneur. He tried to be entrepreneurial with a company called Northern Bakeries that everybody forgets about, which was
completely sucked it up. And the poor man who started the bakery was like bankrupted.
That's correct. The company went bankrupt. And then he was the, again, get back to those two streams in business. For the appeasers, for the professional managers, he was exactly what they wanted, because he would help them to become wealthy while he got wealthy. And in many ways, I remember, I was doing a lot of work with ETV at my old company at MoneyWeb, that we had a good relationship with them. And I remember going, remember Deborah Patter? I mean, she's just a superstar, Deborah. And Deborah was, we were talking about a deal that ABSA had done with Tokyo Sekhwali in, I think it was 1996. And I said to her, essentially what's happened here is ABSA has given Tokyo a 3 billion rand gift, because they gave Tokyo share options. And the square off was, no, we've got to create entrepreneurs so that people can relate to. And the big argument that many of us had at the time was, if you want true empowerment, we'll put it into the way that the Indians did it, where they put it into trusts, which then produced dividends, which from the company's shares, which then enabled people to get a better education and to loans, etc. Instead of making these few people massively and ridiculously and pathetically wealthy. Now, say what you like about Cyril. I don't think he's ever had a grasp on entrepreneurship. I think that he has been very well looked after by the business community back then, and he made his money in a way that is not really adding value, but it's more like Warren Buffett talks about the super helpers, the shuffling of the wealth. So we mustn't look at him from that perspective, but where we can be very grateful was that he does understand, he's had exposure to business, and he understands some rudimentary parts of economic policy and thinking, which his alternative had absolutely no clue about. So I think in many ways, when Ramaphosa won in 2017, there was a huge sigh of relief by any sensible human being in saying, well, the chances of us going along the Zimbabwean path now are substantially reduced. And that is why Cyril gets such a good press, I think, from the business community, because the alternative was just too ghastly to contemplate. But we're getting through all that.
I love this comment from Azalea, and we'll get to your answer from Pumi's question about the GNU in a second. But Azalea says, Cyril was a union rep in the mining sector. If you've ever met one, you'll know that they're slippery. I think that's a very good point.
They're succeeding if everybody is equally unhappy.
Yeah, he did well. His biography the fat biography from the UCT professor Butler is really well worth reading. It unpacks. The reason I know it so well was I made a stupid mistake years ago of acquiring the license for the podcast for that biography, and I didn't know what reading a book. I mean, how difficult could it be? It took me 3 months. And pretty much nobody watched the audio book at the end. So, but I tell you, you read a book for 3 months, you kind of get to know what's in it. And isn't it? We're all interesting. We all have good and bad. But I think to classify Cyril as a business insider, leader, understander, that's pushing it a bit far.
So Pumi's question about the GNU, because I mean, one of the main drivers for kind of having someone of your experience and the exposure you've had to business in South Africa, which I don't think there's anyone who comes close, frankly, the access that you've had to smart people who kind of do know how those gears work. The GNU, I said the words cautiously optimistic at the beginning of this setup, because I know that these things are hugely prone to falling apart. And at the moment, it seems like it's holding. There are going to be arguments. There are going to be ministers who resign. There might even be presidents who resign along the course of this this
or
new
are recalled.
Yeah, or are recalled. And I think it's going to be interesting to watch. But from an economics point of view, how are we set up in terms of the winds that are blowing all over the world at the moment? What kind of a place could South Africa be on the extreme positive? And what could be the worst case scenario?
Again, we need to get perspective on young democracies. And if we go back to England's far too old, but if you go back to the United States, there's some lovely parallels. And you've heard of Tammany Hall. You can imagine that kind of corruption. And it wasn't that long ago that the United States government was a terribly, terribly corrupt place. So yeah, it's almost like you have to go through those learning curves. And to me, the GNU is another one of those learning curves. I remember tackling a few of the politicians in the DA, Helen Zille in particular, Steenhuis, and it's not really, you know, Zille's the one there who kind of is the brains of the place. And she was very, very cautious in saying, in joining what Herman Mashaba and some of the others were saying about, we will never do a deal with the DA. Well, I mean, with the ANC, that didn't last too long for Action SA either, but that's all ancient history now. But Helen is a person of great principle. I worked with her at the Rand Daily Mail many years ago, and she was a wonderful journalist who went into places that nobody else would back then from the journalistic community, and she unraveled and brought to light many, many, many bad things. But from her perspective, she played this very well. She did not lie to us, and we then know that it was probably in her mind that the ANC would get below 50%, and they would need a partner. As it happened, Zuma came to the party. We all know it's all ancient history, and that's the way the cards fell. What I think the DA is doing right now is they are saying, and of course the public approach is, we are doing this to save South Africa, but they are showing the public that what they've been able to do in the Western Cape and in numerous towns around the country, they can do, and in the city of Cape Town as well, they can do on a national level. Because up to now, there's been a little bit of a reluctance from most people to trust that the DA really can implement what it's managed to do at a small level on a bigger one. And so letting them into the government of national unity has been from Ramaphosa's point of view, I asked R.W. Johnson about that. But from the DA's perspective, they now are going in there and they're going to graft and they're going to show that they can do things, and they've put their brightest and their best. And remember, politics, and especially opposition politics, has not really been a career option for lots and lots of very bright people in South Africa, because why would you? Why would you go and sit on the opposition benches forever in a pretty boring environment? Everything you say is being ignored. It isn't like there was abundant talent going into this election. They've attracted some really, really, really incredible people, and not just them, other parties as well. But the DA has taken the best of its best, and it's put them into positions where they are. I mean, Leon Schreiber's from Princeton University educated. He's not a dummy, and he's going to make a difference at Home Affairs if it kills him. Dean McPherson's doing the same thing at Public Enterprises. In his portfolio anyway, with a whole infrastructure story. And then you're getting the wild cards like Gayton McKenzie, who's got a point to prove. Whereas if you were a cadre, what was the point that you needed to prove? So I've got a feeling that Ramaphosa, while he might not be that good at business, is a very, very shrewd politician. And in this way, it could be a way of showing up those in his own organization who need to buck up. And all round, I think the GNU, you've got all of these. Of course, it's fragile. Of course, anything could happen. It could fall apart. But for the moment, there are serious incentives for all of those who are participating to stay together, to keep working harder. And we, the citizens, we, the people, are finally being prioritized, which hasn't been the case for a long time.
Oh, Alec, the DA with bold-faced lied to all of the people they brought into their coalition. Because even as on the one side, Herman Mashaba was saying, we're not going to get into a coalition with the ANC. We never are going to get into a coalition with the ANC. The DA brought all of the disgruntled, said, we're going to be this coalition together, and then lulled them all into a false sense of security about who their partners were. And post the election, the DA turned around and made a deal with the ANC. Like that for me, and I mean, we've had the conversation. The DA is that, and this is how the DA rolls, right? Because look at what happened with Patricia de Lille's Independent Democrats. They're no longer there. Look what happened with Mampela Rampela. She's no longer there. And this is what the DA does, but we saw it coming.
I don't know so much. You know, if you have a look at, probably if you did a poll of all the politicians and you said, who is the most honorable member of parliament? You might find that quite a few of those votes would go to the leader of the IFP. And they've stuck with the DA. They've stuck with the DA throughout all of this. The DA has, I'm not an apologist for the DA at all. I think that they've got some, there's some terribly unreliable characters who are there, unfortunately being brought along from the past. But I do like the people they've been bringing in, the new people. And I do like Helen Ziller because I've known her for a long, long time. And I think she's honorable. As far as the new world that we're going into, mm. I'm excited by the coalitions. I'm excited by the fact that Herman can say, okay, I'm going to support the ANC mayor in Johannesburg as long as I've got checks and balances from my side. In other words, I look after, we'll say, he says, after the legislature, so I can get in there and I can help to improve things, because coalitions are it's a whole new ball game. We haven't had those things in this country. We have no experience of it, and we're learning as we go along. But I'm loving this, that different coalitions are.
They still gave us back the worst president we've ever had in Cyril Ramaphosa. That's my one big gripe. But I do want to talk about Gayton McKenzie, because Gayton McKenzie, going into this election, was a bit of a wild card. And here he is, now sits in a portfolio which a lot of people look at as a junior portfolio, which I think is actually a wrong view of a portfolio that has so much potential, in that it's got sports, it's got culture, it's got arts, which all over the world, these are the areas, some countries like South Korea, for instance, have made so much money, have made such big contributions to their GDP and the repositioning of their countries in the world. And we sit with Gayton McKenzie. What do you think he's going to do there, if anything?
He's a very interesting person. I've just finished reading his first autobiography called The Choice, and I'm sure that keeps him humble, because he is a guy who's really set in the fire. I mean, spending 8 years in South African jails where rape is it's just kind of the norm, rather than to stay away from it is extraordinary. How he got out of jail before his term ended, he's completely honest about it, and he became a huge whistleblower and took enormous personal risks to get there. And it's a guy who's done wrong. He's gone through the fire. It's that beautiful story of someone who's back. Yeah, exactly. And I just think that Gayton's got no filters. Many people in the business community criticized us for giving him a platform. I don't know what they think we're supposed to be accepting for giving people platforms, but anyway, he's been growing into his new portfolio. It's been interesting to me to see where previously people would have criticized him and he would have struck straight back, where now he says, I'll talk to you when I'm out of government. but as a minister in this government, this is the way that I will deal with you, or this is the respectful manner in which I'll deal with you. Yeah. I think the athletes are very excited about him, very, very excited, because if there's been one area where the Cadres have been plundering to the cost of those who should have been benefited, and that's definitely in the sporting arena. It's awful what's happened in many, many sports in South Africa. And Gayton's not the kind of guy to allow that to continue.
Can I just throw this in here? Because I think we, as South Africans, we're so easily persuaded by characters and personalities, and, you know, and people who promise this or deliver that or whatever. But actually, politics is just about pragmatism. And coalitions are just about pragmatism. It doesn't matter whether you think someone's honorable or whether you think that they've got a colorful character or whether or not people like them. The reality is that politics is about what Thabo Mbeki would say, the art of the possible, right? So sometimes it's pie in the sky to think that you can achieve a certain coalition in order to get something over the line. But in other times and in other places, it's very, very practical for people who are uncomfortable bedfellows to get together and for the greater good and to their credit to do something which is to the advantage of the people of the country that they're supposed to be governing. And I see this happening. I mean, you mentioned Action SA, but I think that they are very duplicitous in Action SA, because now they're trying to apparently remove the Tswane mayor. You know, so they've struck a deal in Joburg. But it was Thabo Mbeki who called Tony Leon the Chihuahua, right? this Chihuahua of a party is now causing trouble in the two major metros in Gauteng, which is an irritation, and they're not being practical. And unfortunately, the voters of Action SA did not create, did not support this party so that they could make a noise and cause trouble like the EFF or MK are. They actually voted. Herman sold them a bill of goods, and now he's not delivering, and he's not being practical. And I'm disappointed in him, frankly, that this is the case in Tswane, but mostly because I live there. And I hope that the place doesn't get run into the ground by a lack of leadership, where we've had a mayor who's been trying his level best from the DA to do a good job, and Action SA has ostensibly supported him. That kind of thing makes me think, you know what? There are no good people and bad people in politics. They're just people who will compromise and people who won't.
That's true. That is absolutely true. But and some of the new players, Alec, what's your view on some of the new players that we've got sitting in that National Assembly? We now have 14 parties, and we've got some brand new people or some old people in new shoes, like Bosa with Musi Maimane. What do you make of some of those? And interesting, and when we saw his maiden speech at the State of the Nation debate, Songezo Zibi. What do you make of some of those new people?
I would like to think that the average IQ of the South African Parliament has gone up quite a few points. And certainly the talent for the people who are there for the right reasons has increased significantly. And that's another reason why I remain so excited and so upbeat about my country. Because we see it often in business. When you see a company that's in terminal decline, there's not much that you can do to turn it around if the business, the industry that it's in is... that the world is changing away from it. And if you, however, have, say, a new group of managers who take that business into a different area where they can start rising again, then the whole perception of that organization changes. And I've got South Africa Inc. is governed by those people who are in parliament, our management, if you like. And the quality of our management has significantly improved from the previous legislation. Songezo is he's a smart cookie. He's written a very thoughtful book. He is going to make a bigger contribution than the whoever it was that he replaced in that parliament. There are others. I mean, Muzi's a class act. There are different views on Muzi, but he is, again, I'll come back to this honourable thing, and I hear what you say, Gareth. You don't set yourself up or lead with your chin by saying there's an honourable politician. But he's got to be close to it. He's a man of God. He's got a different North Star in his life to people who are just there to grab what they can. So I like your point, because that is something we forget. And if we've got a better management team, we will have a better outcome. And we have a far better management team today than we had in the previous governments.
I like the management team analogy. And this, with so few minutes left, might be a big question, but let's see if we can tackle it. Speaking on the South Africa Inc., the business analogy and the management analogy, all businesses at some point need huge capex to grow, right? Political party funding. So my vote counts. Just won their bid in, I think, in the Western Cape High Court around the political party funding, the minimums and the maximum allowed by various donors, and actually the telling us who is paying for what. Also a big conversation going into this last election, the Oppenheimers and how much they've put into the various political parties, Moshal and how much he's put into various political parties. How do you feel about the way that we are funding politics in South Africa and the various players who are in that space, and how we should be funding political parties in your view?
Well, I love the fact that it's disclosed. It reminds me of what happened on the Johannesburg Stock Exchange until the late 1990s, where directors of companies could buy and sell shares in their companies completely anonymously. And we had some awful situations where Dave King was an example, where he started this company, pumped up the share price, and then dumped his shares, and nobody knew he was the one selling. He made a billion rand. And of course, that became a big court case with SARS. Eventually, he ended up paying them over 700 million rand to settle. So to have you know, that story about shining light, or light is the best disinfectant, that's a great thing. But I would remind you that in Washington, D.C., there are 30,000 lobbyists, and their sole job is to influence politicians. Yeah. That's what they get paid for to do. In our country, we don't have that. We don't have these – well, we have lobbyists, for sure, but we certainly don't have 30,000 of them, and they're not fating and – I mean, there's another word for bribery. I don't know it's a polite word, I guess, how you can describe it. But I do think that to have the Oppenheimer daughters or granddaughters funding South African political parties, where, again, they could live anywhere in the world that they want, shows me a commitment from that family to our nation and to our democratic project.
I mean, you could always argue that they're allowed to waste their money anywhere they like. It's their money, right? I mean, you know,
it's not a waste.
Well, you know, back Song Gezo, as much as you've said nice things about him, I mean, you're kind of wasting a couple of million rand. I could think of a few things that any of us might do with that few million rand that might be more valuable and useful than putting two or three backsides into chairs in parliament. But as you also pointed out at the beginning of this, you either are worried about your day-to-day money, which for most of us is not billions, or you're the kind of person who wealth is really now a number and you're able to make a contribution in some way, shape, or form, and you choose to rather than not to. And I do think that that's a great thing. I mean, if we're going to evaluate anybody, then that's a pretty good basis to evaluate their total contribution to South Africa on. I also think what Alec said earlier, Pums, is really instructive. It's this idea that you can make the cake bigger. It's not about cutting the cake into ever smaller pieces. And the people who've really built up South Africa from a business point of view and who've contributed massively to the economy and grown the employment opportunities for South Africans and helped us become, you know, a trading power in the south of this continent, and perhaps even continentally, one of the most important countries in Africa. These are not things about just cutting up what we've got into smaller and smaller pieces. It's making the whole thing bigger. And we haven't done that for a while. I think that this opportunity that we're presented with now, and with the world economy in the state that it's in, we have a unique opportunity now to really do something that hasn't been done for a long time. Don't you think?
No, I wish we could get more people. Unfortunately, so many more people are poor than not. I wish we could get more people involved in the idea of, no, seriously, in the idea of
funding. I'm laughing because someone says here, Garrett's answer sounds like he's open to some Oppenheimer funding. No.
One of the other things that in America we see a lot more of is we see a lot more of individuals being party to how they fund their political parties, whether it's individual donorships, whether it's, you know, monthly or yearly, whatever. But more people are interested in participating in the funding of their political parties, where it's not just the rich guys that fund their political parties or the lobby groups and all of that kind of stuff. And I hope that as our democracy matures, South Africa also gets to the place eventually where it's more than just the R5 you pay for your party card that you sacrifice and put into building your political, you know, your political party's war chest.
So let's give Alec the last word here, because I want to have some kind of Nostradamus moment from you. I mean, where do you, because you have the perspective that maybe I don't. Give me an idea of where you think we'll be in a year, 5 years from now, if we keep treading this path that we're on now.
Well, something Fumi said a bit earlier about capital investment, that's what the country needs. The country needs to be investing in its future. You can't grow a country if you're not putting money into productive assets. And unfortunately, we have a system here which has become terribly contaminated, which is not incentivizing people to invest in our future. And I think that if we can just get those politicians that serve us to realize that they should be, the best way they can serve the country as a developing country, and this is a critical point, developed countries don't need money because they've already developed to a point where they can just run on the infrastructure and things that they have. I mean, they have to keep reinvesting, but they're self-funding. Developing countries are like startup businesses. You need people to give you money, but they're only going to give you money or invest in your business if they can see that there's going to be a return for them, because they have many other startups that they can consider. And South Africa has been a startup that has been chasing away potential investors for too long. If we can turn that around, the sky's the limit. And I do believe that it really comes back to, you know, where's the capital investment coming from? Where is this injection of resources that can open up the opportunities to everybody? Because if you've got a pie that you said earlier, Gareth, if that's not growing, then there's not new opportunities, especially if your population's growing at, 1.5% a year. So we've got lots to do here. But it starts in the basics. Think of it as a startup. Think of it of how do we get people to invest in South Africa? And you're not going to do it when you put all kinds of restrictions which don't exist elsewhere in the world. And get that right. I don't know how much further, how much higher we can go, but we can show the world again that we are a country that always punches above its weight when our hands are not tied behind our back.
I love it. Alec, thank you for your contribution to independent media. I mean, it's not an afterthought. It's something that I wanted to say in the introductions. But I'm thrilled that we could spend some time with you this morning. Pums, we're back in the saddle. We'll see you in a week's time for more of The Burning Platform.
More of The Burning Platform next week.
Cheers, everybody. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.